Well, first of all, I want to thank you for inviting me. It's an honor for me to be here. It's my first time at the UCM. And, well, today what I'm going to talk about is the ectorotic universe. And essentially, it's an idea I've been working on for about a year and a half now. It's essentially an attempt to try to solve some of the problems of the Big Bang model without using inflation. So it's an idea which has evolved in the last 6 months or so quite rapidly. But today what I'm going to present is sort of the latest or sort of the simplest version of it. So it might be a bit different from what you've heard before, but it's sort of the simplest way to understand it. So the way I'm going to divide my talk is sort of in the first part, I sort of present an overview of the scenario without going into too much detail. And in the second part, I intend to present recent results which have to do with a comparison and contrast with inflation. So some we'll see there are some similarities and some differences. So, so let me first, before I move on to describing the scenario, I'd like to put this work in context. So if you ask the question, how did the universe begin? There's essentially, if you look back in sort of the history of humanity, there's basically two schools of thought. So in the first school of thought, the first school of thought proposes that the universe began in sort of this chaotic, high-energy state. So essentially, you assume that there's some beginning of time where the universe is chaotic. An example of that is goes back to the Milesians, in particular Anaximander. So in their model, there was, at the beginning of time, if you like, you could think of the beginning as where all the opposites form some sort of primal unity. So things like warm and cold were together, and moist and dry. And at some point, well, at that point, they separate, if you like. So in modern language, you can think of this as the expansion of the universe. And later on, they recombine to form life. So the last point, you can think of it as being sort of structure formation, and so on. So in this school of thought, you have, say, the Big Bang model, and its inflationary component. So, right, because in the Big Bang, you assume there's some definite moment in time. I mean, most inflationary models do have some Big Bang singularity in the past. So you assume that the universe begins in this chaotic state, and then there's an inflationary phase which follows from that. And your initial state is as chaotic as you want. And the second school of thought proposes that the universe began, if you like, in the simplest state possible. So the universe doesn't need to have an initial time. It sort of more or less stays quasi-static and sleeping for a long period of time, and is vacuous and so on. And then something happens which leads to the creation of matter and life and so on. So an example of this is the Babylonian Genesis. Well, their idea is, their cosmological model, if you like, was that there is no initial time, and far back in the past, the universe is sort of composed of three forms of water, some homogeneous mixture of those three forms of water, like seawater, salt water, and cloud water. And at some point, out of this sort of mixture, gods are formed. And so in their idea, if you like, the water represents inertia and, if you like, inactivity. And then when the gods are formed, these represent movement, motion, activity. And the gods are eventually the ones which create life. So you also have examples in Parmenides, also is in that school of thought. And you also have the pre-Big Bang model, which assumes that you begin with a state which is asymptotically trivial, if you like. And the model I'm going to describe today sort of falls in that category. So now you may ask the question, given the question, why is the universe that we observe today spatially flat and homogeneous, you would ask, what's the answer provided by each school of thought? So in sort of the high energy beginning, if you like, because you start at high energy, you have many states which are available to you. It would be silly to assume that you start in a state which is special or symmetric, because there are so many states available that don't cost you much energy, and which don't have any symmetry. So you have, if you start high energy, you have to start with an arbitrary state. And if you do that, then to get a universe like our own, you need some sort of attractor mechanism which takes you from those chaotic initial conditions to homogeneity and flatness. And the attractor mechanism is inflation. However, if you start from a quasi-static state, then when you have gravity in the game, quasi-static states are typically special, or they have symmetry properties. So you could imagine that you have some principle, like supersymmetry, which provides a selection rule so that your universe is forced to begin in this state, which is a state which has maximal supersymmetry, and which has nearly zero energy, and if that's the case, then one thing that's nice is that, say, in the context I'm going to be interested in, say, heterotic M theory, it turns out that the BPS states are homogeneous and flat. So if you assume that there's some symmetry principle which forces you to be in that special state, then, say, supersymmetry ensures that you'll be homogeneous and flat. So now this all sounds nice and neat, but there's still a challenge if you start with a state which is highly symmetric. And that is to say, if you start with a state which is symmetric and static, you have to explain to me how you go from there to a universe which is expanding and which has matter and radiation in it, the universe we observe. So that's one challenge. And the other thing is that the universe we observe is not perfectly homogeneous and spatially flat. I mean, there are galaxies which are in homogeneity. So you have to explain how you go from this really nice and static and special state to a state which has fluctuations to produce galaxies in this evolution. And that's what sort of the ekpyrotic universe will do, essentially. So let me describe the setup. So, I mean, in the talk, basically, I'm going to go back and forth between I'm going to go back and forth between two languages. So I'm going to go between the 5D picture and the 4D picture. And sort of there are elements which are easier to understand, or in which we have more intuition when you talk in 5D, and others when you talk in 4D. So the 5D setup, what I imagine is that here's my space-time, if you like. There are these three-dimensional boundaries, three spatial dimensions, which bound a compact extra dimension, a fourth spatial dimension, which I really think of as being an S1 mod Z2 orbifold, and those guys are simply the orbifold the orbifold fixed points. And so this guy, on these walls, as usual, there's a gauge theory and matter degrees of freedom living on each of them, whereas gravity is allowed to propagate in the bulk. I'm going to consider the simplest possible model in this story. So think of here, visible brain is where we live and our particles and so on. And a hidden brain is sort of a hidden gauge sector. And the distance between those two brains is measured by this field phi, if you like. So that's just the usual story. And at the 4D level, if I ask what's the 4D effective description of this system, well, it's just the action we're familiar with. So if I'm only considering gravity and the scalar field phi, and I'm also going to allow for a potential for this scalar field phi. And I can always put the 4D effective action in this form by performing vial transformations and field redefinition to make this canonical. So because this is the action you know and have seen, then the equations you get from this are just the usual equations. So you get, this Friedmann equation, and so on and so forth. So this is all familiar to everyone. Now, what about the potential phi, the V of phi, if you like? So what I'm assuming is that, so what this V of phi represents is essentially a force between those two boundary brains. So I'm going to assume that when the gauge coupling is small, then this potential is basically zero. So at the perturbative level, the potential is zero because essentially the system has BPS solutions. So essentially there's no force between the brains at small coupling, and the states are BPS. However, as I crank up this gauge coupling, what happens is that there are non-perturbative effects which become important. So an example of that is that we know that there are, say, M2 brains, which is virtual M2 brains, is essentially stretched between the two boundaries, and those guys generate the potential for the phi field. And the type of potential I have in mind, if you like, is this kind of potential. So later on, I'm going to motivate why I'm interested in this kind of potential. But for the moment, I'm just going to show what I want, if you like. So what I want is a potential which is negative. That's one thing. And I want it to be attractive. So it brings the field so that the brains move towards one another. And I also want it to go to zero as the distance between the brains get large. So that's essentially the kind of potential I have in mind.
So you explain why you want, more about why you want that kind of potential. Will you say how you derive that?
Okay, so what I'm not going to show how I get that from string theory. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that, so I mentioned the exchange of membranes.
Yeah.
That's only one effect. There are other effects which generate a super potential, if you like. So the full super potential is not null, so I cannot. But what I'm going to present for you is, given the definition of what ecchorosis is, why does the potential have to be this way? So it's not a fundamental derivation, it's sort of a backward engineering. So now let me describe the dynamics. So initially I'm assuming, as I said, that the universe is as simple as it gets. So I'm assuming that the distance between the brains is large, and therefore the potential is near zero, and the state is nearly BPS initially. So therefore, because of that, if you like, then the universe is almost empty, almost static, spatially flat and homogeneous. That's sort of my initial condition. But then, because of this potential, if you like, the brains begin to attract, so they start moving towards one another. So that's the 5D description. In the 4D description, because the potential is negative, if you look at this A double dot equation here, then because V is negative, both terms on the right-hand side are negative, and therefore A double dot is negative. So if you start from A dot being approximately zero, you start from a static state, then A double dot is negative, and therefore you begin to contract. So what happens is that the universe begins to contract as the brains move towards one another. But I'm going to assume. I'm going to assume that what I want essentially is that it's going to be contracting very slowly. So this is all far. Yeah.
Why should the contraction be spatially uniform in 3+1 dimensions? So the BPS state, they're absolutely flat and parallel. That's the supersymmetric one.
Right.
And if there are many slightly excited states above that, yeah. The vast majority of them involve little wiggles here or there,
right,
in 3+1 dimensions, but not sort of the brain moving in lockstep.
Right.
I mean, from the 4-dimensional point of view, it's like a phase transition happening everywhere at once.
That's right. So essentially you're saying, well, what if I have perturbations of that BPS, which are spatially homogeneous?
Yeah, that's more like it.
I have no answer to that. I mean, my assumption is that somehow you start in a state which is spatially flat and homogeneous over today's scales. I mean, there could be wiggles, but then the wiggles have to be consistent with today's observations.
In your sense, are you explaining it?
Well, what I'm going to explain is essentially how you can go from there, as I said, to a state which has matter and radiation, has perturbations which are consistent with today's observation.
Oliver is right that if you have sort of have to assume that the state isn't exactly BPS, otherwise nothing will happen at all.
Right.
That is not exactly BPS.
That's
if
right.
It is nearly BPS, there's no reason for that. The discrepancy from BPS to develop in a homogeneous fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's quite contrary to what we would normally expect as a generic evolution.
Right. So to some extent, I mean, this is, to me at least, a bit of a weak point of the story. At the end, I will present some sort of, so that was sort of the motivated by symmetry argument, but there is another argument which came up recently in which you do get this initial state. For the moment, I think, just for the purpose of this discussion, I'm not trying to sell you anything, but the purpose of this discussion, I'm just going to assume that when enterosis begins, that you're in that state. And at the end, I'll sort of show you maybe how you could get that state, or if you don't like the symmetry argument. So it's going to be a different argument that I'm going to present at the end. But for the moment, let's just assume you begin in that special state. Right? So essentially, so the brains come together and eventually they're going to collide. But I do want to emphasize, I mean, it's in one sense, am I explaining anything? I'm explaining how you get from that state to something that looks like the real universe, and that's really not trivial, at least to me. So eventually the brains come together and they're going to collide, and their collision is going to be inelastic. So what's going to happen is that some of the kinetic energy of their motion will heat up. Will heat them up, if you like, and so you can think of this as creating the gauge and matter degrees of freedom which live on them. And they collide and they bounce, and when they bounce, that corresponds to the universe going from a contraction to an expansion. So I'm really, because now the universe is expanding and you've created all this matter and radiation, then that's really, I'm really thinking of this as the beginning of the hot Big Bang phase. So now the real thing is that you don't want your universe to be at collision to be perfectly homogeneous. You want to have perturbations on super horizon scales, which are going to lead to creating galaxies and so on. So what happens is that, so I need to discuss with you a mechanism to produce those perturbations. So the way to think about it in 5D is that those guys, classically, they move and they come together perfectly parallel. But quantum mechanically, they're going to develop ripples as they come towards one another. And so in the 4D picture, the way to describe it is to consider perturbations in that phi field, which describes the distance between the brains. Turns out that the equation that this perturbation, say a K mode, particular Fourier mode, it satisfies an equation of this form. And the important thing about this equation is really this factor of 2 here. So people who are used to working with inflation, the factor of 2 sitting there, why it's not 1.5 or 3, is crucial, because that factor of 2 implies that these perturbations are scale invariant. So I can talk a bit more later about how in this case it comes about that you get a factor of 2, but in some sense, yeah, that's crucial in this case.
Maybe you could just briefly state what the assumptions are that are behind getting out the factor of 2?
Yeah, so, okay. So later on I'm going to show what I mean by ekpyrosis in terms of, and what I mean is that really the universe is slowly contracting. That's number one. So gravity during this whole process is basically unimportant. Because not the geometry for all purposes.
Just the brain's rolling in the potential.
Right, exactly. It's just the five field is just rolling down the potential, not knowing about gravity. Now, in the inflation, so the 2 over t squared, right, has, in general, this term has two contributions, if you like. I'm being very schematic. There's a V double prime term, and there's an A double dot over A term. Okay. This term is obvious, because if I take the action and I expand it quadratically, you pick up a V double prime. Well, that term, you have to do the integral of gravity and you find this out. Now, if in inflation, the potential is very flat, so V double prime is negligible, so you forget this guy. Mm-hmm. And you're left with this, and for this center space, A double dot over A is 2 over T squared. In our case, gravity is unimportant, so it's actually this term which drops out. Mm-hmm. So you're left with this. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out, if you neglect gravity, and you assume that, I'm going to show a bit later the conditions and the potential for ekpyrosis, mm-hmm. if you have slow contraction, mm-hmm. then I can show for you what it means for V. I'm going to translate this into conditions on V, and then this translates into a 2 over T squared. So it's all going to be okay. The bottom line is that it's really the potential which is doing the trick.
According to, I'm a little confused, a double prime over A is 2 over T squared in inflation in the center space.
Oh, sorry, in conformal time.
In conformal.
Yeah, so in conformal time, A goes like T. Goes like T squared.
So, and then in flat slicing in conformal time.
Sorry, it goes like 1 over T, sorry. Yeah, and it's flat slicing. So in inflation, it goes like this. And then that's where it goes. But I'm glad you asked that question, because later on I'll come back to that when I talk about gravitational waves. So anyway, so basically, so when the waves are moving together, there's this delta phi which is building up. And how does that lead to a spectrum which is, how do I go from these fluctuations, these wiggles in the brains, to actual perturbations in the radiation fluid which I'm going to create? So I'm going to give you a heuristic derivation of how that goes. So if you have a delta phi like this, this translates at collision into time differences in collision between different regions. So there's going to be, for that mode, a time delay for the collision time given by delta phi over phi dot. Now, heuristically, think about two regions colliding, two neighboring regions colliding. So you have one which collides first, then it reheats to a particular temperature. And then, because the universe is expanding, it begins to cool. Now the neighboring region, delta T later, collides and reheats again to the same temperature. But now, by the time everyone is heated up, right, then there's a temperature difference between those two regions. And those temperature differences is what you measure on the CMB time. And later on, you know, generate galaxies and so on. So a bit more quantitatively, this is the equation of energy conservation for fluid, right? And so I'm thinking of this as being the radiation fluid. Then if two regions collide a difference of delta K in time, delta T in time, then what you get, you know, I take the rule here, so it's delta rho over rho, is then just H times delta T. And if I then plug what delta T is, I get this guy here. And this is exactly the kind of equation you get, say, in inflation. The bottom line is that because delta phi k is scale invariant, right, because of this factor of two, then both in inflation and neck porosis, delta rho over rho is scale invariant. That's the conclusion. This is just a back of the envelope of proof of why that works, but we did a careful calculation. So, all right, so now, I'm going to briefly talk about how the universe goes from contraction during the ecchymosis phase to expansion after collision. I understand that Neil Turok gave a talk here recently about this, so I'm going to go a bit more briefly on this. So essentially, the collision occurs, the collision between the brains corresponds to the big crunch. So during ecchymosis, the universe is contracting and eventually hits a big crunch, and that big crunch corresponds to the collision of the brains. So what can you say about that big crunch, if you like? So classically, you would think that there's nothing you can say, because at that point, curvature is getting large, so string theory becomes important, and so on. But there's still a couple of things. You can make sort of an educated guess as to what happens at collision by looking at variables, classical variables, which remain finite at that collision. So let me define. So essentially what I'm going to do is make some sort of rough argument to provide evidence, if you like, from what the answer from string theory is likely to be. So if I define these variables A0 and A1 in terms of A and phi in this way, then first of all, you note that these two guys, these A0 and A1, are geometrically the induced scale factors on each of the brains. So in other words, you take your 5D metric and you look at the induced metric on each brain, and their scale factors are those guys. Not little a, but those guys. And the collision, of course, the big crunch, occurs when the two are equal. The bottom line is that those guys and their time derivatives are all finite as the collision occurs. So effectively, you should think of those two brains coming together and colliding. Those guys, A1, A0 dot and A1 dot, are like their velocity. So it's like two walls hitting at finite velocity. So it's quite natural, if you like, that actually they're just going to collide and bounce.
Excuse me?
Yes.
So
A1, the scale factor on one of the frame, what is meaningful metric here? Does it mean that the geometry on the frame is open or something?
No, it's all, the metric is spatially flat at any surface of constant y. So it just means that each brain sees a different scale factor. That's all. So think of it as the bulk geometry has some warp factor associated with it.
But I saw data would be positive, right? The scale factor would be positive.
Yes, it is. Oh, you mean because of this negative sign?
Yeah.
So this is a detail. Actually, phi is negative as you approach that. And, they're both positive, yeah.
Can you show us that potential for phi again? Explain maybe even that picture.
What do you want to know?
So, I didn't understand that either. I mean, by scale factor, you don't mean the actual size of size of each brain?
So essentially,
it looks to me like phi is positive. So the second scale factor.
Oh, this is all
negative number.
Yeah, no, it's not. Trust me. I mean, some of this you have to trust me on.
I mean, the two pictures that don't fit together.
No. Of course. So this is actually, there's many things that don't work about this plot. So first of all, phi is, if you take the bulk to be ADS, phi does not go to infinity as you make the brains large. It just goes to zero. And second of all, it's negative. It's not actually. It goes from minus infinity to zero, so it's negative. But I just.
So can you draw the correct picture for phi?
Yeah. Actually, better than that, I'll just show you. So here's the distance between the brains, and here's the potential as a function of the distance. And what I want is it does this. Okay, tends to zero at large distances.
And
B, if phi, if B is related to phi at small distances as this. So when phi, and actually the full formula is a bit more complicated, but at small distances, that's what it looks like. So when B goes to zero, phi goes to minus infinity. Mm-hmm. Really, that's all you need to know. And if you want, we can talk about it later. But I'm glad you asked this because.
But this is what we need to know for the other picture. As
yes.
So phi is going to minus infinity.
Yeah. All you care about for minus infinity is the time when they're close together. The rest.
And that's why the two scale factors are the same when they collide.
Yeah, and they're both positive.
Right.
But one thing I should say is that as the distance, so as phi goes to minus infinity, their gauge coupling, if you like, the spring coupling, in the Fourier theory, goes like e to the, I forget the exponent, but e to the phi, let's say, or e to the 2 phi, which goes to zero. So the gauge coupling goes to zero as the brains come together. I mean, you know that because think of Poiseuille-Witten theory, right? When the brains are close together, this is really the periodic spring theory picture. When they're far apart, it's really the Poiseuille-Witten. So the spring coupling goes to zero. And so, because this potential is actually a non-perturbative potential, it actually is gonna, it's gonna come back to zero very close to small distance. And so the argument I presented about A0 and A1 actually assumed that there was no potential. So I'm assuming they're really in that very narrow region.
You're saying that both brains are expanding to infinite scale factor as they approach each other in color?
No, the scale factor remains finite. There's the scale factor that they see remains finite. What are you saying to me?
Well, could you go back to the other transparency?
Yeah.
I think the point is that in the five-dimensional metric, the induced metric on the brains is not becoming singular.
That's right.
But then there's an effective four-dimensional description when you rescale that sort of induced four-dimensional metric.
Yeah.
And that's what has the differential.
And this Kaufman cinch presses the five-dimensional metric.
That's right.
On the five-dimensional transition, they do become interesting.
No.
I mean, cost, minus.
No, that's the point. So A goes, so I'm sorry, I guess I did this a bit too quickly, but essentially,
A goes to zero,
phi goes to minus infinity, and their product, and the product remains finite. So as Professor Horowitz said, essentially, as this is occurring, the induced metric on each brain remains perfectly fine. So the singular thing in that picture is that
I guess let me just also ask that this probably is the answer to something that was puzzling me a little bit when you talk about the perturbations.
Yeah.
Because you might say, why should anything about the, why should this argument about the perturbations survive through a big crunch? I mean, big crunch, the curvatures in this four-dimensional description are all becoming infinite.
Right.
In some sense, what you're telling me is that the big crunch is happening at different points at different times, but I know it's a big singularity, so small perturbations, you know, the curvatures are all becoming infinite. It doesn't sound like anything that you build up before the big crunch
will survive.
Will survive through the big crunch.
Right.
But I guess the answer is that from this five-dimensional standpoint,
absolutely,
curvatures are all finite.
That's right. So for the perturbations, I'll come back to that a bit later. But essentially, in the same way that I've, so the way to think about it is that, well, it's my next experience. So that, let me just go with that transparency now. So essentially, so the conjecture is that they collide and they bounce, and when they do so, then the universe goes from contraction to expansion. But the point is, and that's related to the perturbation thing, is that because matter and gauge degrees of freedom, which live on each grain, they couple minimally to A0 and A1. Those are the scale factors to which they couple. And because their time derivatives are finite, what it means is that the reheating temperature is finite. So as far as the perturbations are concerned, it means that those fluctuations, there's a sense in which they don't become singular because precisely the temperature to which they correspond is finite. That's a whole trick of the game. So, but I'll come back to that a bit later about this. So,
I'm confused. So you're saying that, well, I thought that one of the pictures earlier is that they collide and stick, but then you're expanding, of course, in the four dimensions.
Right, so that was
3 plus 1.
Right, no.
But now you're actually saying they collide and then they separate.
So in the picture you're talking about, that was sort of the first paper, was that we found that you had those two guys that I'm talking about now, which basically remained fixed. And then there was a third guy, which was admitted, went through the ball, collided and stuck.
Yeah, okay.
That guy which was traveling is an M5 grain, there's reason to believe that it's going to stick. In this case, those are orbital fixed planes, and there's no reason to believe that they're going to stick. They might, I don't know, but the likely thing is that they're just going to come in balance. It's a conjecture. I want to move on to the second part, which is going to describe sort of the recent results, and I find that it's going to be nice because actually we're going to contrast it with inflation. So let me review some of the things I've already said. So in inflation, your initial state is at high energy and you're chaotic. Whereas here, you began at low energy in a state which was highly symmetric. The dynamics, if you like, in inflation, the universe is expanding really quickly. Whereas in ecthyrosis, I'm defining it as being a period of very slow contraction. Inflation occurs shortly after the Big Bang, so a small fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Whereas ecthyrosis occurs well before the big gap. The duration of inflation, if you want to produce fluctuations on today's scale, today's horizon scale, you need about 10 to the minus 35 seconds, so a very, very short time. Whereas ecthyrosis, to produce fluctuations on today's scales, you need about a second. So it's much longer time scale to work on. The conditions on the potential, so that's sort of the interesting part. So I'm going to show you in the next few transparencies, in inflation, if you like, how do you define inflation? If you have a potential which is positive and which is sufficiently flat, so in other words, V prime is small and V double prime is small, then essentially your potential is very flat. So the field, you can think of it as rolling down slowly, and so the energy density is dominated by the potential energy, and therefore you enter the sitter phase. What I'm going to show in the next few transparencies is that with this definition of the universe contracting very slowly in ecthyrosis, then these leads to these three conditions, namely the potential is negative, V over V prime is small, And there's a third parameter, which essentially implies that V double prime over V is large. So if you look at this, then you see that actually the two sets of conditions are almost the mirror image of the other. Here you want the potential to be flat, here you want it to be steep. The physics of this is that in ekphorosis, you want, as you said earlier, you want the field to be rolling without knowing about gravity. So to do so, you need the potential to be steep enough. That's why you get this.
This one-step time scale, this refers to the time when you start the brain to move, or
it says to a collision. It says, imagine you're in the ekphorotic phase, right? Mm-hmm. Question is, you have some mode which is of the order of today's horizon scale. How long is it going to take from the moment that that mode crosses outside the horizon till the Big Bang? And the answer is 1 second. So ekphorosis could have lasted for a long time before then, I don't care. But the time, the minimal time it needs to last long enough to have perturbation of today's scale. And that's 1 second. So it's a lower bound. Does my answer make some sense?
Yeah. I'm just wondering, is the time scale when the collision happens, or with the time scale when you start to have this brain breakout starts growing?
It's counting backwards from the collision.
Right? It's counting backwards from the collision. So counting backwards from the collision, so play the tape backward in time. They were like this, they move apart and backward in time.
Oh, okay.
And you go backwards, and modes are, successive modes came outside the horizon. The horizon is growing as you go back in time. And you ask, how long does it take for the universe to be to today's size?
Where did this
scale
come from, once again?
Where did it come from? So I'm just being very schematic. I assume some reheating temperature of the order of 10 to the 12 GeV, right? So there's some reheating temperature when the brains collide. And a natural number we get is say 10 to the 12 GeV.
This number with the parameters you are using, how does 1 second model?
Well, think about it this way, right? So today, imagine the universe reheats to 10 to the 10 GeV, right? So that defines for you a Hubble constant, right? So there's some scales associated with 10 to the 10 GeV. So here's that scale. The ratio to that scale compared to today's horizon is e to the something. Yeah, it's e to the 50 or some large number. And associated with that scale, there's also a time scale, 1 over h. And if you take 1 over h and multiply by e to the whatever, you get more or less, roughly speaking. So that's why it's exponentially longer than a short time scale. Now, the spectral index, that is to say, what's the spectral shape of the perturbation spectrum? In inflation, so by scale invariance, I mean that NS will be precisely 1. And in inflation, if you do the calculation, you find that it's almost scale invariant, but the deviation from scale invariance is given by these two small parameters. So it's indeed nearly scale invariant. In ekphorosis, I'll sort of show a bit later that a similar equation holds, if you like, that the spectral index is almost scale invariant, but that the departure also given by these fast slow parameters, I should say. Now, the final point is very important, is that in inflation predicts that you not only produce scalar perturbations, like the delta rho over rho that I presented earlier, but you also produce gravitational waves. And the spectrum of gravitational waves is scale invariant. Whereas in ekphorosis, you don't produce at all any gravity. I mean, the gravitational wave spectrum is very, very blue. So there's no way you can measure it. So there's no gravitational wave. And if you want, I can give you a heuristic argument again. So in inflation, so let's recall that story here, right? I said that the 2 over t squared is what gives you scale invariance. Now, in inflation, I said this was the guy which was playing the role which gave you the 2 over t squared. And any scalar field, any massless degree of freedom, will couple to gravity, and therefore will have this permanence perturbation equation. And since this guy is 2 over d squared, then any perturbation of a massless field will give you a scale invariant spectrum of fluctuation. So in particular, the graviton, you can think of it as 2 scalar flows. That tells you that it's going to be scale invariant. But in ekphorosis, this term is completely unimportant. And it's really this term which is doing the job. But this guy is a potential for phi only. So only phi generates a scale invariant spectrum of perturbation. The other guys are all the other massless fields do not.
Okay. Since the last time you said I'm very more on the, that when suppose we collide two things at one point, we have the equation governing the dimension of the mode.
Yes.
Now at that point you generate deviation.
Yes.
Now neighboring points where you collide would be affected by the deviation generated already over there.
By what?
Deviation has been generated, so it will spread out, right?
Will spread out?
So the neighboring point where the planes collide, the equations will be modified by taking account of the matter between the neighboring planes.
Well, those equations are you breaking them writing down?
Think of it this way, Mike. When the grains collide, the initial conditions, because the grains were flat and homogeneous and everything, the initial conditions are just, say, like an FRW universe in which you start time immediately.
Right, the fluctuations on those grains, the evolution of fluctuation, you're all using the same equations for the fluctuation terms.
Right.
But the production of matter at the given collision point, it's not modeling things.
I think if you have brain collision that is good enough to give you small perturbations at all,
yeah.
I mean, the places where the radiation would have to go much faster than the speed of light to affect where the brain collides next. I mean, you think that this is a slightly inhomogeneous collapse. The way that the place propagates where the brains have already collapsed is probably faster than the speed of light.
Right. So that's a good point. So, So the effect you're talking about is what would be the time scale of, say, I have just one wiggle localized, and how does it, what's the time scale of it spreading out compared to the time it takes for? I'm assuming that that's very small. To me, it kind of makes sense. But it's the causal region at the time that this is happening. So the time scale of this spreading out, as you say, is basically the inverse Hubble radius, so 1 over h. But that's very small because my reheating temperature is 10 to the 11 GeV. That's essentially, that tells you how far will a signal propagate. Right, essentially, it's 1 over h. And that's very small, so it's a good approximation.
Okay, so unfortunately, I don't think I have time to actually show you these equations. For those interested, I could tell you at the end, but I'm going to assume that that's the case. Essentially, assuming very slow contraction implies that these equations must hold. And what I'm going to do instead is show you talk more about the perturbation. So at the beginning, I gave you this sort of heuristic derivation of what delta rho over rho ought to be. But if you do a careful calculation, what you get is this. So it looks like a horrible mess, but it's actually quite simple to understand. So you have some numerical factor in front. Then here you have the ratio, essentially, of radiation that you produce to the total energy density. So at collision, some of the energy goes into reheating the universe, and some of it just goes into kinetic energy of making them bounce, if you like. So there's going to be some fraction here, which I square. And I'm evaluating this at a particular moment in time. That's no worry for us. So it's some small ratio, if you like. Times the Hubble constant at reheating, times this h over phi dot, which I evaluate when a mode comes outside the horizon. So for a particular k mode, I'm evaluating when that mode comes outside the horizon. And then there's this other factor here, this exponential, which is also evaluated at horizon crossing. So if you now compare this with inflation, is the same, the similar result, the analogous result is that you have some number of order unity times h of reheating, if you like, and times h over phi dot, which is evaluated at horizon crossing. So if you like, this guy
this term here is roughly speaking this guy, but there are these extra factors. So let me describe a bit how, what are the differences. So first of all, there's this factor of this efficiency factor, if you like, which is by definition less than one, but which could actually be quite small. The reason is that, as I said, as the brains collide, the string coupling is going to zero. So presumably this efficiency of producing radiation is probably getting small at that point. So this ratio is actually, I think, would be small. Now, there's this factor of h over phi dot, which seems to be the same in each case, but actually it's the same, except it has a different value in each case. So h over phi dot for both ectorosis and inflation is just v over v prime. However, for both of them, you can show that. However, v over v prime for inflation is much bigger than 1 because the potential is flat. But as I said earlier, in my case, the potential is steep. So v over v prime is actually much less than 1. So although this h over phi dot term looks the same for both, in one case it's a small number, in the other case it's a reasonably large number. And then finally, this exponential factor is typically of order 1, so we don't care about it. So because of these different factors, which are smaller, if you like, this guy and that guy tend to be smaller than in inflation, it seems that to get a small amplitude of 10 to the minus 5, say, that seems to be easier with ectorosis than in inflation. At least that sort of, as I said, I'm not trying to sell you anything, but for me at least that's sort of one attractive feature, because in inflation, the most restrictive constraint on the potential, if you like, if when you hear stories like getting so if you have lambda phi 4 and you want lambda, you need to get lambda 10 to the minus 14 or some small tuning like this fine tuning, it comes about because you want this guy to be 10 to the minus 5. So it seems like in ectorosis, the constraints on the potential will be milder coming from the amplitude. So that's one thing that's encouraging. However, if you look at the spectral index, so as I said, okay, so essentially if you compute what this spectral index is, you find that in terms of the potential in ectorosis, it's given by this, which you can re-express in terms of my fast roll parameters as this guy like that. So in inflation, as I said, you get something similar. You just get in terms of those slow roll parameters where I've put them there on the board again. So it looks like things are very similar, right? Both of them just depend on these small parameters. However, there is a difference in that there's a sense in which getting the ectorotic parameter a dot to be small is actually a bit more restrictive than getting a dot to be less than 1. And why? So in other words, getting scaling variance seems to be a bit harder in ectorosis. And the reason is that, consider the lambda phi 4 potential, which I've talked about. If you want, so for inflation, consider this potential. If you want eta to be small, then all you need to do is to take phi to be large enough, right? You take phi large enough and the potential will be flat enough. However, the corresponding potential for ectorosis, say V is minus lambda to phi to the minus 4, the analogous thing, you cannot make 1 minus this eta parameter, you cannot make it small. Essentially, it's equal to 3/4. The reason being that, essentially, this constraint of having 1 minus V, this guy essentially forces the potential to be nearly exponential. So it's a constraint on the power that appears here.
What are you holding fixed? Why is that one natural analog of lambda phi to the 4?
Oh, I'm just thinking. So the potential I had in mind was over there was some sort of exponential potential, which is dying. So I'm just saying, rather than having an exponential, let's take just a power law, which has the same features and it's dying down this way and so on.
It doesn't have anything in particular to do with the lambda phi to the 4.
No. It's a very... No, it's just, I'm just saying that here it's just the power law. So in inflation, what you would like is a really, really flat thing. But then people realize, well, you don't really need a flat thing. You just need phi to the fourth if phi is large enough. I'm just saying, in my case, take just the power law. then in my case, you need the power law to be, the power to be large enough. So if I conclude, if you like, essentially, as far as the potential is concerned, getting a small amplitude seems easier in ekpyrosis. That is to say, it's less restrictive of V, but scale invariance, at least for me, seems a bit more difficult. It's more of a restriction on the potential. So in the last few minutes, I'd like to talk about the proposal which addresses a bit what I was asked earlier on about the initial conditions.
Before, yes. Since you're switching gears here,
yeah.
So things may look less restrictive on potential, but still you got this assumption about the initial conditions which you have to put in,
right,
in the ekpyrotic scenario, and there's not really a parallel assumption that you have to make in the inflationary scenario, is there? There's a qualitative difference there.
Well, the sort of thing I'm going to talk about now will kind of address that, but if I could address this question within what I've said so far,
yes.
I would say that, and I'm not an expert on inflation, so don't mark my words, but essentially, in inflation, you have to be careful. So we've been a bit brainwashed, if you like, with the notion that, oh, inflation, you take any initial condition, and you can get inflation out of it. And actually, it's not entirely true. You have to make as well an inflation, because you start with a state which is as chaotic as you want. Mm-hmm. You need to make an assumption about things being homogeneous within a certain size. You cannot assume. So in other words, if you assume that you start with chaos, mm-hmm. in inflation you need to put a cutoff on the kind of chaos you start with. Mm-hmm. And that's to me rarely talked about, because people like to say it's an attractor mechanism, but there's a basin of attraction. It doesn't cover all possibilities.
Was there some way of comparing how strong of an assumption that is with the assumption that you have to make an extra in terms of the
people have worked on this
condition?
Yeah. So you're essentially asking, what's the story with inflation?
I just want to know roughly if they're, if you're making assumptions that are nearly as strong in that case.
I cannot tell you, because I don't know. I don't think people have worked out in a quantitative way what happens with inflation. That is to say, if you like, the question would be, so I have my chaotic state, and I'm going to choose it to be as chaotic as I want. You would like to ask the kind of question, what are the odds that today I'm in a patch which has inflated? And that's, I think that's one way you want to rephrase a question. And essentially, because the volume you have is infinite, right? Then there's the notion of probability is kind of ill-defined in that case. I mean, it's not an easy question to answer.
Mm-hmm. If you grant inflation, that one is allowed to assume that one has an infinite volume, then I think there's not much of a problem. Then there are bound to be some regions where this that can generate.
Well, even so, it's
the question is whether you can have these start.
First of all, so there's going to be some that are going to expand superlinearly, but a region next to it will be highly overdense, say, will collapse, and even so, it's not clear what's the probability of you being in that inflated patch.
I mean, nothing of you in the one that collapses.
Well, that's an interesting
When you were committing on inflation, you were referring to chaotic inflation or the...
Chaotic inflation, because usual inflation makes similar assumptions to what we're saying, right? The field starts at a particular value, homogeneous, over a certain path. Mm-hmm. So, I'm absolutely referring to...
I don't think that's an anthropic argument. I mean, it's a question of the volume of this
field. Well, actually, when you say usual inflation makes similar assumptions, I guess the point is you're blowing up a region that is small enough that it could be homogeneous. Again, you've got to make some assumptions about cutoffs.
Exactly. You need
one way of seeing it. People did say this 20 years ago when inflation first came out. One listened to it.
People objecting on this fashion.
The point is that you can take any condition today. I mean, say the universe is very homogeneous and isotropic, but just make up some other condition today and evolve it back into the past.
Okay.
You know, Einstein's equations are deterministic and will give you some solution, and it can even go back, you know, through an inflationary phase and end up with just lots of very small scale structure in early times, and that will evolve through a period of finite inflation into an arbitrary, you know, homogeneous state today.
Well, yeah, okay, so you need to make some assumptions about your initial conditions and the measure on initial conditions. And the question, I guess, then is how generic and sensible are those?
But you'd have to engineer weird potentials to get great homogeneities over, say, you know, something smaller than current noise.
Well, not if you start with them.
No, not if you start with very small scale. Imagine fluctuations or inhomogeneities on very small scales at early time.
These are some
finite amount.
Right, but to get a finite amount, that's the problem. I mean,
you won't have inflation, you're saying.
To get a finite amount, you have to really engineer potential and inflation. You know, bend around and give you only so many E foldings, and that, you know, we don't know where those potentials come from, so who knows? But they are whatever they are. It's not like, and that it seems very non-generic to try to do that, because you have to give them all sorts of features. We depend very carefully on what you're setting at the time now.
Why are you talking about?
Well, maybe I should
finish. Okay, so I just want to say like a few words about this, because that's kind of a way in which, so essentially in this scenario, there is no beginning of time and there is no end of time. So it's this universe goes cycles, and so time actually goes from minus infinity to infinity. And so today, if you like, if you ask today, where are we? So the potential I'm showing here is essentially the same kind of thing I showed before, except that it doesn't go to zero at large distances. It actually goes slightly above zero, where this height is of the order of today's cosmological constant. So this is just, take this as being what it is. And today, if you like, the field sits somewhere around here. And this field B plays the role of the quintessence field. So it's causing the universe to accelerate. And it's assumed you can find conditions of the potential so that this lasts long enough so that actually it's going to empty out our entire Hubble horizon. So essentially, by the time this acceleration period is over, what we see now, the galaxies and so on, have been emptied out to being a few quanta. And then at that point or so, because the field that has now dominated the universe, it can start rolling down the potential. So it begins to roll slowly. And eventually when the potential becomes negative, the universe actually, so as it's doing this, the universe keeps expanding. But at some point it's negative, then the universe goes from expanding to contracting. So it begins to contract. It then rolls down, and now this is just the ekpyrotic phase which is going on because the potential satisfies the conditions I said earlier. So the ekpyrotic phase goes on, the grains come together, they collide, they bounce. But when they collide, the universe reheats again. And as they bound, the field goes all the way back up. The kinetic energy brings it back up all the way here or so. And because of the Hubble drag, the field is stopped somewhere around here. And it stays there. And it's at that time, you know, radiation is cooling, so on, everything is cooling down. You have matter radiation equality, galaxies are formed. And at some point, you hit some state, which is like today, and this energy density begins to overtake the universe once again. Quintessence occurs and so on and so forth.
So are the parameters supposed to be the same in each cycle?
That's right. The assumption is that this potential remains the same.
Well, the parameters of the solution are the same in each cycle as well.
The parameters are the same.
Well,
the reheating temperature.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Everything.
I think
you and I are going to be here again in 15 minutes.
Well, okay, so these are details. I don't know all the details, to be honest with you, but yeah. there is some sort of an attraction. I believe that if there is some range you can play with the reheating temperature, because you can end up somewhere here, and if it's fat enough, then you don't care so much exactly where you end up. So there's some sense in which it doesn't have to be exactly periodic. But, yeah. Because essentially, where you start on that plateau here, the solution is insensitive to that. what you're going to do here is going to be the same no matter what. So that's some sense. So in this scenario, the initial condition problem is completely nullified. You don't need to talk about it.
So you're assuming that every time it comes back, it's going to be okay?
Yeah.
It bounces and bounces and it moves out with the same speed as it moves.
No. Right, because some of it goes into the radiation, but actually, if you're worried about ending up here, that's if you make reasonable assumptions about, well, so far I haven't made assumptions about what exactly happens at collision, but if you make reasonable assumptions like conservation of momentum or whatever, the analog of this, then you find that you're very unlikely to end here. Actually, it just takes you right up here. You don't feel at all this well. The field just zooms over it.
But how do you know that you're going to be reproducing the same conditions as you approach that point every cycle?
So you go and compute it, as I said, making some assumptions about it, what the reheating energy is.
Do you have to tune that? Or?
No. I mean, reasonable assumptions, as I said,
that in fact,
like conservation of momentum, you allow small deviation from that. So really, as I say, reasonable conditions, nuclear power.
So this would, if you look at it from the Brehm scenario, what happens is that it's collide and then separate and then collide back?
Yeah, that's right, just like this one.
Okay. But presumably, there should be some energy loss to the collision. This wouldn't last forever.
Yeah, no, energy, how should I say, your notion of energy is strict because of gravity. Gravity is, energy is simply going back and forth between the gravitational field and matter, gravitational field and matter. That's what's happening. So if you like, when you're sitting